51551, the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we'll start with those movies. An interesting threesome. Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones reunite for the Aeronauts. Two grandees of British cinema, Dame Helen Mirren and Sir Ian McKellen, join forces in The Good Liar. But there's only one part of the threesome we can start with. Martin Scorsese releases The Irishman in cinemas this weekend and on Netflix in a couple of weeks' time. And the cast list here includes Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci, Harvey Keitel, and that's only the start of it. Roe McDermott and Simon Marr have been to all three, and they're with me in studio now. Yeah, we have to start with The Irishman. First thing is, Martin Scorsese, cinema is dying, cinema is dying. These streaming people, they're going to kill cinema. So let's do a movie with Netflix and just put it into the cinema for 2 or 3 weeks before it actually is going to be available on your telly in your front room.
Yeah, now in fairness, this isn't an unprecedented move because we saw this last year with Roma when they put it out and it was going to be a Netflix release and got a lot of funding from Netflix. But they do also want it to be eligible for the Oscars, and for that you need to have a theatrical release. And so there is a bit of cynical award baiting there. But also it's an interesting thing. I think for this film in particular, I think it's very interesting that it's going on Netflix because it is 3 hours, 40 minutes. And I will say that all the critics were going in trying to figure out, like, if someone needs leave to go to the bathroom, like, who's going to tell them what's happening?
See, if you're at home, if you need to leave to go to the bathroom, you pause it and then you come back downstairs and you continue on. Anyway,
but that's also slightly blasphemous in a way, because the whole idea of having a feature film and opposed to a series is that you absorb everything, and particularly for this film, it's about absorbing the lives of these three characters, and Frank Sheeran, played by Robert De Niro in particular, and seeing that growth and evolution uninterrupted.
Right.
So it is interesting that Scorsese.
So Simon, give us a sense of the three characters. Ro has already mentioned the De Niro character, Frank Sheeran.
Yeah, and Frank is the main character
here, really, aren't we?
We are. Now, he's a very small town thug, and it's really his story, and it's told over the period of right the way he starts off the film, and he's a very, very old man, and he's telling this story, and then we flash back to the very start, and then it works its way through its timelines as it goes along. And the first guy that he meets Joe Pesci's character, Russell, and he meets him when he's still delivering, you know, and he helps him to fix his truck, you know, and that's the first meeting that we have, and then it develops on from there. It turns out that Russ then is also great friends with Hoffa, who's played by Al Pacino.
And these are real people.
Oh, these are real people. Yeah. These are real people. And there's these little casual references all the way through, because in case you needed any explanation, a little caption will come up about somebody, and it'll be, you know, Fat Tony, and it will be gunned down in his bathroom in 1980. You know, so you get to grips with who these people are as it goes along. But you see his relationships with Russell in particular, who I suppose is his mentor as it develops, and then when he goes off and spends some time then with Jimmy Hoffa.
All right, okay. Well, here's the moment at which De Niro's character, the Frank Sheeran character, and Hoffa are meeting up, but they're meeting in a telephone call, and it's Joe Pesci is kind of introducing them.
Yeah.
So he's the first voice I think you hear in this clip, handing the phone over to Robert De Niro.
Let me put McGee on the phone.
Hello? Hey, my friend, how are you? Listen, I got that kid I was talking to you about here. I'm going to put him on the phone and let you talk to him, okay?
Hello? Is that Frank?
Yes.
Hiya, Frank. This is Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah, yeah.
Glad to meet you.
Well, glad to meet you, too.
Even if it's over the phone. I heard you paint houses.
Yes, yes, sir, I do. And I also do my own carpentry.
I'm glad to hear that.
I understand you're a brother of mine.
Yes, sir. Local 107 since 1947.
Yeah. You know,
our friend speaks very highly of you.
Well, thank you.
He's not an easy man to please.
Well, I do my best.
Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci and Al Pacino in that clip from The Irishman. And I should have clarified, I was just checking with you, both of you. The Sheeran character is the Irishman of the title, and it's his story we're hearing. How does this rise out of, before we get into CGI and all of this type of stuff. Does this rise out of just a straightforward mobster interaction with the unions, interaction with, I'm presuming, loads of corruption elsewhere? Does it rise above that into something else?
I do think it does. And I think Martin Scorsese, I mean, he has become known as just the master of crime films and has explored these themes like crime and loyalty and guilt and remorse and power, essentially, and greed a lot in his films. And I think this film could only be made by a director as mature as Scorsese at this stage, because it's about these characters and it's about their interactions, but it's also about what leads a man to become so hungry for power that he is comfortable, as they say very euphemistically, painting houses, which is killing people.
Yeah, you'd maybe explain a little bit of the code we heard in that phone call.
So Frank Sheeran's memoir is called I Hear You Paint Houses, and that's a reference to I hear you splatter the walls with blood when you shoot people in the head, essentially.
And carpentry,
that's his little joke and saying, yes, I can also cover this up. But basically, so what Scorsese is examining is basic men in America, masculinity in America, and what can drive a man to believe that to be a good man, it means supplying for your family and making them powerful and getting them money, and also taking out your enemies and being loyal to people no matter what they ask of you. So it's a film that necessarily looks at an entire life in America. So living through World War II, living through Vietnam, seeing presidents get assassinated and absorbing these messages, and then asking, is it any wonder that these men return from war and live through these things and have defined themselves by efficient violence, disposable relationships and selfish quests for money and power?
Does the history then serve as a backdrop to the story of Frank Sheeran and to effectively the story of these three men? Are there being comments made about the history along the way and politics along the way
You see little bits, like you see little vignettes. You see one scene where he's talking about how he was supposed to learn how to paint houses, but he's in the war, you know, and he's got these guys that I can't ever understand, you know, why these guys would dig their own graves. And it's a shot of him getting two soldiers to dig their own graves. And then the shot, there's casual things, there's the references go in then about, there's a reference to, well, if we could get the president, you know, a shot, then obviously we can do whatever we want. So there's that all the way through.
And John F. Kennedy on the television in the background.
As it does all the way. And they talk quite a lot about Bobby Kennedy, because Bobby Kennedy, of course, had gone after sort of a lot of the mob bosses of the time. But as the movie goes on, you start to wonder, is this just going to be, you know, a biography of life and crime? But you start to see as it moves on that it's really all about consequence. You know, it's like you've built up, as Rose said, you've built up these sort of these characters as to this is what they thought they had to do. But then they start to see that there's actual consequence. So it's not like a Goodfellas sort of there's tremendous crack goes on here. It's like this is my job. He could be a painter or a carpenter, you know, it just so happens that he's a killer.
And I think you really see that in the third act, because the first two acts are all about the action and getting to know all the players in this game. And as Simon said, they're introduced in kind of flashes and you see the mechanics of this world. And then the third act is really about, because it's being narrated by an elderly Frank Sheehan. So it's him looking back on his life. So it's that idea of, do you feel guilt? Do you feel remorse? Do you wish this had gone differently? Or did you absorb these messages of power?
And here we have three actors essentially in their mid-late 70s playing this span of the lives of the three men involved, the three characters involved. CGI technology plays a big part in aging them down.
Yeah, because there are flashbacks to when, for example, when Frank Sheehan meets Joe Buffalino, or Joe Pesci's character Buffalino, and so they meet when Frank is around early 40s. And so the de-aging, it is distracting at the start, particularly in close-ups, because people's eyes become a bit glazed. And there was a moment where I was like, this is like watching the Polar Express.
You also said that they give Robert De Niro
blue contacts, which I actually find really distracting throughout the film, because they want to make him look more Irish in opposed to Italian American with his brown eyes. So I think that's slightly distracting, but it does get less distracting as time goes on. And I will say, I think the performances are incredible, and they're such a testament to the actors, because Joe Pesci, he brings this almost very gentle paternal side to his character, because he's overseeing violence rather than inflicting
it. He's not having to do the dirty
exactly
work.
But it is
ominous. There is like there's a very very understated ominous nature there. It's like he is
it's patriarch.
He is that paternal figure. murder, but I would kill you in a second.
And given that the film is called The Irishman, how Irish is the story? How Irish-American is the story?
It's not particularly Irish-American. There's talk about how he gets in there, that Frank gets in and he manages to become, I suppose, much closer to a lot of the Italians than a lot of the others do. Mm. You know, he ends up part of a fraternity. There's only three guys, you know, with a particular family ring, you know. But it just every so often, you'll just be a little, there's a little reference. He's going to knock off yet another guy at one stage, and the guy calls him, "Hey, Irish, how are you?" And then, obviously enough, that's the last line he has in the film, it is for many people when they have their interactions with
Don't
Frank.
Call me Irish.
Don't call me anything.
Which of the characters is, we see a glimpse of the relationship with the daughter, but she has, what, a half dozen lines
or something? So this is Frank Sheeran, so this Robert De Niro's character, and I think this is where I thought that some of the diversions into other, you know, some of the other mobsters and some of the other crimes could have been cut down and this could have been focused on, because I will say none of the women in this get to talk to each other. They have one line each. They're very briefly glimpsed at, except for Frank Sheeran's kind of favourite daughter, Peggy, who we see at the start, and she is reprimanded by a shop owner, and Frank hears about this and goes and does something horrific to the shop owner, and she sees this. And so as a young child, she kind of understands that her father is very volatile and understands power, and it's about her watching her father as she grows up and her relationship with his violence and what she does and doesn't know. And that is, it's touched on briefly and it is incredibly emotional and plays a bigger part in the third act where he's looking back over his life. But I do wish that was developed and that, you know, some of the women got to speak.
I wanted to ask you briefly just in terms of the aging down. You know, if we'd had aging down in The Godfather, we would never have had Robert De Niro as the young Don Corleone. We just would have had an age down Marlon Brando.
Yes.
That would have been it.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't like aging up makeup, I have to say, either. But is there, should they just have had different actors playing them, or would that have broken up the 3 hours and 40 minutes of unity?
I think it has, because it's one of those things that's very much Scorsese's designed this to be watched in a sitting. You know, and I do think that because of the period of time, if it had started from being a kid a la Goodfellas, it might have made sense. But because he probably is 30s, 40s, you know, when we see him first, that it wouldn't make sense for it to be somebody else. And
what about the young actor that didn't get the job?
Well, that's true for him. But as it goes on, it does become less noticeable, but definitely at the start you're going, I can see why he's doing this, but by the same token,
I also think because there are so many characters in this film and they are all white men, it would be very confusing.
Alright, will you go back and watch it in the cinema? Will you say to people, go and see it in the cinema before you sit in front of your telly at home and take the breaks and go upstairs and make the coffee, and maybe your 3 hours and 40 minutes will become nearer to 4 hours in a total city? So give me the advice, which is it?
I think it is beautifully shot, and Scorsese's work is always beautifully shot, and he plays with form and he plays with ratio to represent time, and so I think that you absorb the kind of sumptuousness of it and then the coldness and the iciness of the violence. So I think watching it on a cinema screen is how it's designed, but I will say it's too long. Like, it is too long, so I completely understand people wanting to watch it in the comfort of their own homes.
And stars from Euro?
I think it's a 4 out of 5. I think it is really excellent, and I think it just shows Martin Scorsese, he's one of the very few actors who are directors who can examine the same themes but never feel redundant, and that is very impressive.
Cinema or home, I guess, is going to be the same answer.
It's got to be cinema. Like, he does, it's one of those things you kind of go, well, if you've gone to all that trouble of making it and having it look this good, then you should watch it in the cinema. And it's 4.5 out of 5.
4.5 out of 5.
I'm taking the half off for it just being just too long. Easy half hour you could have chopped off that.
Right, and you felt you wouldn't have missed it. And they're now in line for the Oscars, and I'm sure watch this space for that one. Right, let's move on to film number 2. Another kind of true story at the heart of this. Much shorter running time, it has to be said, in The Aeronauts. And we have Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones back together again. Only these two actors would have these two characters, a pioneering meteorologist and a tormented hot ballooner.
Of course.
Explain who is who.
So we're in the 1860s here, and James Glacier, it's based on true events. Rather than them saying it's based on a true story, they say it's based on true events. And Glacier, he wants to prove the science behind weather forecasting. And people are saying, no, this is hokum. This is never going to be any use for anybody. So he has to go out and he finds Amelia Wren, and Amelia Wren is a very, very well-known pilot. And he says to her, well, look, we're going to have to go higher in the sky than anybody has ever, ever gone. And to do this, it's a hot air balloon.
All right, that's the only way to do it. Well, here's the moment. I think this is pretty much very close to when they meet up. So there are obviously flashbacks involved here as well. This is when they meet up and he is explaining to her what it is he does and what it is he wants to do.
Mr. Wren, sorry, I'm a scientist, an astronomer, and a meteorologist. And
a scientist, an astronomer, and a what?
I believe that the weather can be predicted. Mr. Wren, I need to make studies of the air. And I need to be in the air. And I need you to help me.
Do you even have a balloon?
Not yet, no.
So you make an invitation to me when it is I... You should be inviting
me. No, I need us. I need you to fly us higher than any man or any woman has ever been. What? To understand the weather, Miss Wren, is to understand how to make ships and sailors safer, farms more productive, so we can prepare ourselves and our world for floods, for droughts, famines. We could save thousands of lives. I want to rewrite the rules of the air, Miss Wren. And I need your help.
Sounds like she's warming up for Henry V there once more into the breach type of thing. So that's Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones, who had been together in Theory of Everything, and here they are to get together again in The Aeronauts. Meteorology obviously was a very young science at this point in time. And is it telling the story of that science as much as it is telling anything else?
Well, I think it's interesting because in real life, the pilot of the balloon was a man. So they've gender swapped this for the story. But I think it's which is going to enrage historians and men's rights activists. But I think it's a very clever idea for this film because it represents Glaisher as a man who was ahead of his time and ahead of his field, and people literally laughed at him when we posed this. And then you have Amelia Wren, who is a pilot and an aeronaut, who is seen, and she is a widow and her husband died in really tragic circumstances that she's still grappling with, but she's incredibly independent, has no interest in marrying again, and has become a bit of a recluse. She drinks too much, but she is seen as a woman ahead of her time because she's just defying all these norms of gender. So you have these two outsiders who want to go together, and they're really united by their passion and their ambition and their desire to do something extraordinary. But in another way, they're complete opposites, because Glaisher is a scientist and he's very detail oriented and very rigid in his thinking, where Amelia Wren is all emotion, kind of both the highs and lows. So we meet her first and she's having a panic attack and suffering from PTSD, remembering the death of her husband. But then she arrives and they're about to take off in this balloon, and she comes basically dressed like a jester, a carnival jester, doing acrobats and sprinkling glitter everywhere and setting off fireworks and saying people who come to see a balloon take off aren't interested in the science. They want
to
show
see the balloon taking off.
And then the director kind of embraces that, because once the balloon takes off, it becomes a show. It becomes a spectacle of action and adventure.
So is there a balance then to be struck? Just hold on. Let me stick with the truth thing, or as it was suggested me to say, truthy is what Stephen Colbert might be saying about this.
Yeah.
If you're telling a true story, if it's based on a true story, should you just get on with it and do what's dramatically necessary, or should you be rigid in the historical facts? How important is that? Does it matter in this movie?
No, I think if you were writing a book, you would probably write a book that would be very true to the science of it. Where if you're making a movie like this, it turns out, and you can tell even from the tone that he took in that last clip, is that this is an adventure. This is a huge adventure. And once the balloon takes off, because it takes off, you see balloons over London and then you see them go up and you go, oh, this could look a bit good. And then as they start to get higher and higher, and you actually, as I was watching them, started, I'm getting the willies here, because it's so well done, and there's such a feeling of real peril that's going on.
Let's listen to a clip when they're up high in the air and what could be approaching, but perhaps a storm.
We still sure this weather will hold, because my instinct is telling me.
Instinct has no place in weather prediction.
You're lying to me.
Every reading that I took this morning was quite clear, Miss Wren.
There are no advantages in concealing concerns. We are trapped here no matter what you say.
This pressure is changing faster than I'd anticipated.
And so it begins. I'm not sure your instruments are much use to us now. We need to batten down. There are no prizes for obstinacy. James, if you won't listen to me, listen to that.
Wait, not one of my readings suggested a storm.
Well, that's what it is. And we're inside a cumulus, which is precisely where we shouldn't be.
Don't worry. She's not made of conductive material, so we won't attract lightning.
And if we are struck, the gas will explode, so we won't live long enough for me to point out. Ah!
Is she outside the balloon?
Both of them at some stage end up outside the balloon. Yeah. It's quite dramatic.
Well, then don't tell us what happens, please. Anyway, that's Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones in the Aeronauts. You get a sense of it there that clearly there's a strong bond, a strong, you know, chemistry between the two of them. Do they keep that chemistry to be purely about the science, purely about the meteorology and the flying? Is that what it's about? Does it head down the romantic route?
No, it doesn't really. No, they have a reliance on one another, and you can tell that there's a trust and a bond between them. And it, sort of, occasionally it leans towards them maybe flirting with each other and flirting around the idea a little bit. But really then it gets back to what I think is what Tom Harper has done really well with this movie.
He
doesn't get away from the really good stuff, from the adventure stuff, for too long. You know, it's that you're never too far away from somebody climbing up the side of a balloon or hanging off the side of a balloon. I was sitting watching the film and going, you know, they're really not dressed for 40,000 feet or whatever height it is that they're up at, like, you know. But it managed to do that. It paces it well.
But I presume, given that it is about this hot air balloon trip and journey, that the most of the film is just Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones in the balloon.
Yeah, so they feature on that. And I will say, it looks spectacular. And I think the idea of...
Is there CGI involved in the
look? There is CGI involved, but also cinematographer George Steele does some beautiful work. And I think the idea of what needs to be true and not what needs to entertain modern audiences is that they kind of have to capture how groundbreaking and how stunning this is, and they have to do it for an audience that is au fait with, like, space movies essentially. So they do capture these scenescapes and these skyscapes that are truly stunning and are kind of reminding me of Gravity, that idea of looking at Earth from a huge distance.
The film with
Sandra Bullock and George Clooney, where they're literally ascending into space, and I think it is in competition with them in terms of the beauty of it, and it's something we haven't seen. So I think
a similar dynamic in some ways, isn't it?
Absolutely. Trying to do something extraordinary. But you have to remember it's for that time. So I think they represent that really well on screen. I think there are some flashbacks. So we see how the two characters meet. We also see what's going on with their family dynamics, and we see what's kind of happening on the ground. It unfolds in real time. And I will say, as the film went on, I really wanted less of the flashbacks and I wanted less interruptions.
Keep me in the
balloon. It takes you out of the momentum, and that's what's really thrilling.
All right. As if you enjoyed this one as well. Stars from you first this time, Simon.
I thoroughly enjoyed this, and I think probably what the makings of the film, as well as everything else, all the beautiful stuff and the science is in it, but Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones are just great, and they work so well together. So I'm going to give this 4.
All right. And what are you saying, Ro?
I really enjoyed it. I think this is definitely one to see on the big screen, because I think just the visuals need to be experienced and you almost need to have almost vertigo watching it. Yeah. I think the script got really dodgy towards the end and very stilted. And I didn't think Eddie Redmayne's character was represented particularly well. He felt one dimensional. So I'm going to say 3.5. But it's a really lovely Sunday afternoon film, like a really good adventure to watch.
But it's not on Netflix in 3 weeks' time.
It's not. So, how are we going to cope?
But it is going to be on Amazon, which is a funny way. It's Amazon funded, so I think it's going to be on Amazon the 26th of December or something to get in just before the Oscars cut off.
But I will say, this would be such a good film to watch around Christmas with the family, a great action
in adventure. The cinema. Perhaps.
In the cinema,
Right, let us move on. This is the night of casts, it has to be said. When you look at who was in The Irishman, when you look at the duo we've just had in The Aeronauts, and then The Good Liar, which puts Dame of the Realm against King of the Realm, Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen are sparring partners in this particular movie. What is the setup, first of all, for me, Simon, The Good Liar?
Well, Roy is a classic con man on the search for the one last big gig that's going to make him his fortune he's going to be able to retire on, like every other film of this type ever. And he's convinced his ship comes in when he comes across Betty. So he meets Betty on an online dating site, and he goes and he discovers that she's worth a lot of money. I think she's worth 3 million quid. So there's a lot of money. They go, they meet up, he tells her who he really is, you know, but doesn't tell her anything else. And then it's like, okay, now here's my chance to go and make a whole pile of money.
All right, well, I don't know if this is at the moment of meeting, but she's kind of interested, Betty, played by Helen Mirren, as to whether Roy, played by Ian McKellen, is a regular online dater.
So tell me, have you done this a lot? Met people on the computer service? Don't you find it's always the same?
You mean the anticipation followed by the letdown? But I tell myself, brace up. This time it will be different. Which is why I must now confess to you a deception on my part. My name is in fact not Brian, it's Roy.
There you go. I was going to say Robert. That is Ian McKellen and Helen Mirren. Ian playing the part of Roy and Helen playing the part of Betty in The Good Liar. The dynamic that's going on here, is it about a big con and him trying to con her, or is this a love story, although it sounds very thrillery with the music in the background there?
No, it's definitely very thrillery and very twisty. And before accusations of spoiler alerts come in, I interview the director, Bill Condon, who was very clear that he said, if you hire Helen Mirren, you do not hire Helen Mirren to play a kind of guileless, vulnerable woman. You hire her to play an incredibly smart woman. So from the outset, you are kind of suspicious and saying, does this woman, Betty, she can't really be that vulnerable and that guileless. Like, she must be suspicious because Roy kind of moves in very quickly. He's like, her grandson is very suspicious of this man who has suddenly appeared and who she's very close with. He knows that she has a lot of money. So the grandson, Stephen, is very suspicious. And you have this sense of, she must have something else going on. So it's not, does she know something? It's what she knows and what her game is. And so in a way, it's kind of, you're anticipating the twists and turns, but that's meant to be the fun of it.
All right. And are the twists and turns sufficiently satisfying? Yeah.
they start off, they go away for a weekend, or they go away in a short break, and there's a couple of twists that start happening. Can they go, okay, yeah, this is possibly something that little bit more interesting. But then it seems that as it gets to the second half of the film, they decide, oh, no, this needs to be far more twisty in order for this to work for us to justify it. And by the end you're going, really? Really? And it's a shame because it has that, it's premise that it builds up on, because the fact you have that contrast from the very start of the, what seems like, oh look, it's two old people dating, you know, but with the thriller sort of undertones going through it, you think this could be something really good.
It just stretches, it just gets, too far, does
yeah,
it?
And it gets lost somewhere along the way.
It's hardly performances, because these are two very talented actors.
No, and one of the joys is seeing Ian McKellen kind of play Roy. Is kind of bumbling and he has a limp and he's very vulnerable when he's around Betty, and then turning into a very suave, very sinister con man who's kind of wheeling and dealing with millions of dollars and dealing with other criminals and double-crossing them and being quite vicious. So that's really fun. But then, yeah, in the second half, they kind of bring in historical elements. They bring in a lot of themes. They kind of touch on issues to do with, but not exactly like Me
Too.
They touch on political divisions and they kind of shove it together into something that should have been fun and twisty. And they almost lend too much weight to these
stars from you, Ro?
I'm going to say 3, which feels a little bit generous. I think the performances are great. I think it starts off really fun and it's always a joy to watch.
From you,
screen.
Simon.
Yeah, I just say for the first half an hour, it's, you know, it's worth a 3, but probably by the end then it drops back to a 2. So I'm going to give it 2.5.
All right. The three films we were speaking about this evening then, The Good Liar, The Aeronauts and The Irishman. Surprise, surprise, all of them on general release and some of them going to be streamed very soon, it would seem. Ro McDermott and Simon Marr on our film reviews this evening.